Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. Today, we're going to talk about media literacy, and we're going to ask the question, what does media literacy even mean in the age of Donald Trump? Last week's shooting at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland, rightfully put journalists everywhere on guard. It's in the wake of a president who has called the media the enemy of the people. And there may very well be reasons why the public mistrusts the press. There's the fact that there's so much consolidated corporate ownership. There are cable TV shows that seem to frame editorials as news, which can be very confusing, but also just seem to rile people up against each other rather than trying to inform. But in the meantime, at local news outlets, newspaper, radio, television outlets across the country, reporters just slog along doing their work, covering important stories about local government, the courts, crime, schools, and of course, good news about what's happening in their community. So what can journalists do to explain what they do to regain the public trust? We're going to talk about that with some people who are working to find solutions in classrooms and communities and in newsrooms. So joining us today is Aaron McNeil, founder and president of Media Literacy Now. They advocate and lobby state legislatures to include media literacy in public school classrooms. They go around the country, they organize teachers and students in more than two dozen states, including right here in California. Aaron also covered economic policy and legislation for the Congressional Quarterly. We're so happy to have you here, Aaron McNeil.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You bet. Also with us today, Lynn Walsh, project manager at TrustingNews.org. Lynn has been a freelance investigative journalist for the past decade, having worked at NBC in San Diego, WPTV in West Palm Beach, Florida, and the Texas Watchdog in Houston, Texas. Lynn Walsh was also the president of the National Society of Professional Journalists, and she now teaches at Point Loma Nazarene University in San Diego. Lynn joins us from San Diego. Welcome, Lynn.
Hi, thanks.
And finally, we have Neil Brown, president of the Poynter Institute, which many of us have heard of. Poynter, as many of us know, is a nonprofit journalism school in St. Petersburg, Florida. They also serve as a think tank and something of an incubator for developing the best practices in journalism. Neil Brown was formerly the editor and vice president of the Tampa Bay Times. He got his start years ago as a reporter himself at the Miami Herald. So, Neil, welcome to Your Call. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So as we always do on the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable, we want to start off on a positive note and maybe give some kudos to reporters out there who are doing good work, who did a particularly good job this week. So, Neil, let's start off with you. What did you see or read this week or hear that you thought was well done?
Well, you know, there's every week lots of good stuff to see. I really thought ProPublica and Frontline have done another good job in their documenting hate series. They identified a gentleman who was at the heart of the violence in Charlottesville, who had not been previously identified. They've been on a bit of a project trying to figure out who were the specific individuals who were involved in the violent behavior in Charlottesville. And through sort of detective work and video searches, as well as searching social posts, social media posts, they identified a guy who was at one of the guys at the center of some of the violence, who, as it turns out, is a PhD in a PhD program at UCLA and is a defense contractor with security clearance for Northrop Grumman. And based on their reporting, this is now being looked at as to whether somebody like that who participated in that that action should get that kind of security clearance. They confronted him. He denied that it was him, but his bosses have acknowledged that it is him, and they're now checking out whether he should continue with that kind of security clearance. So I applaud the sort of shoe leather of not letting go of a very important story and trying to put real detail behind some of the individuals who were involved in one of the biggest events in the news in the last 12 months.
I saw that too. I thought it was really excellent in terms of connecting possibly seemingly unconnected dots.
And, right. I think they ultimately went to him again. It met a lot of good rigorous tests on the journalism. I thought it also was presented with very little sensationalism. The more we understand about these events, and not, you know, sometimes I believe we should, it's important to go narrow and deep. So finding out more about this Rise Above movement that he was part of is important work, and I applaud them for it.
That's Neil Brown, president of the Poynter Institute. Let's go next to Lynn Walsh, project manager at TrustingNews.org. Lynn, what's a piece of journalism you saw this week that stood out?
Yeah, as Neil said, there's always tons of great journalism out there. I find myself gravitating toward data projects, and ProPublica actually has one out where they are tracking who is paying the president. So they found since President Trump said he was running for president late 2015, $16.1 million was spent at Trump-branded properties, so hotels, golf courses. And they, when you go to the website, you can see exactly when the money was spent, who it was spent by, and we're talking a majority of it spent by his campaign and then also other Republicans, but also some government agencies and other groups as well. So it's just a really interesting interactive that you can see is precisely where money's being spent, when, and by who. And I think it's well presented, and they also do some explaining with some other stories attached to it as well.
So much of the shoe leather reporting that Neil talked about does have to do with following the money, as so many news stories do. It's all about the money trail, and ProPublica really has run that to ground. I saw that story too. I thought it was really good. Okay, Aaron McNeil, founder and president of Media Literacy Now. What caught your attention this week?
Hi, Renee. You know, in keeping with our look at the important work that's doing on at the local level, I subscribe to a newsletter called Local Matters, so you really find out all of the important investigative work that's going on by local reporters. And one that I noticed was from the Wichita Eagle, and it's about, over the past few years, Kansas juvenile detention centers holding a number of dozens of possible child trafficking victims. I thought that this was really an important story that probably didn't get a lot of play in the national press, but Jonathan Shorman, the Wichita Eagle, between 2014 and 2018.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that we're able to acknowledge some good journalism. So now let's dig into why people might not necessarily think about great stories like those when they are asked their opinions about the media. We're going to talk today about media literacy. And it seems to me this is a two-pronged issue. On the one hand, the internet has rapidly transformed our information landscape. A Stanford study from 2016 found that more than 80% of students there believed what's called a native ad, and it's identified with the words sponsored content, but 80% of those students thought it was a real news story. So we're constantly being presented with new formats that are deliberately engineered to trick our brains. And it's not just advertisers. We know about Russian efforts to mislead Americans through social media posts. So it presents the question, what can people believe in? How do you become media literate? State legislators across the country are trying to push to have media literacy become part of the public school curriculum. We're going to talk about that today. But the change can only come from news consumers themselves. Journalists seem to expect the public to just trust them, but increasingly clear that the press has got to do a better job of just explaining to people what they do and why their work is important. So, Aaron McNeil, let's talk a bit about how we came to be at this point where it's easy to be tricked into thinking that you're actually seeing news when it's not.
How we got to this point?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm sure there's a long history of propaganda going back, I don't know, to Socrates probably, but if you can just kind of give us a thumbnail sketch of how we came to be in a place when you're not sure, we're not sure what to believe.
Well, I think obviously the internet may have had something to do with that. We have anybody at this point can publish anything they want at a fairly low cost, and I think that's a big part of the issue. Meanwhile, of course, there's the consolidation, and at the higher levels, where a lot of the corporate media, that the corporate newscasters, those companies used to see news as sort of their civic duty, and that was a loss leader, and now it's required to be also to make a profit for the company, so that could be part of it as well. But yeah, this has been true since media was made, and media was made in the caves when people were painting on the walls. So it's been a long way coming. I'm not sure whether some of those cave painters might have exaggerated some of their hunting success.
But we also know that propaganda, fake news, has a long and sometimes very effective history. So you founded Media Literacy Now. So how about giving us your definition of media literacy?
Well, I think it's important to remember with media literacy that there's a lot of parts to it. So media literacy is about understanding the media in front of you, to the ability to deconstruct or analyze that message that's in front of you. Also, the ability to tell your own story, create your own message. It's another key part of this, is creating media. It's just like reading and writing. If you're literate, you can read, but you can also write. But a third important part is understanding the media system and our relationship to it. So, you know, why is this message here? Not just what does it say, but why is it here? Is this message that's come up to the top of my Facebook page, is it there just by chance, or is it because of some algorithm that's put it there? Or who's paid for this message, and why?
And Neil Brown, president of the Poynter Institute, you folks at Poynter are working on a $3 million project, and you have some pretty big names, Google and Stanford, with the goal of helping young people become better consumers of news. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, happy to. In fact, it grows to some degree out of the very research you cited earlier, Renee. By Stanford, when they looked and saw that, I think you said 80% of students couldn't discern an ad, essentially a native ad, a sponsored ad from editorial or independent material. I think we all know that's not a situation that's unique to students. I think that it goes well beyond students, and I think we're currently in an environment where folks now have so many options for their information that they are selecting, unfortunately, too often, information that they pick because they agree with it rather than that they want to be made more knowledgeable by it. But in any event, we are partnering with Google and Stanford on a project that's called MediaWise, and the idea is, in fact, much like Aaron's organization, is to kind of try organically to kind of go back even younger than it may be hard to convert a lot of folks now in a very polarized society, but we're going to try to develop two things: a curriculum for schools, middle and high schoolers, whether it's called media literacy or it's in civics classes, that will work with teachers and students and their parents, so that in the classroom they are starting to learn the kinds of skills that allow you to not simply accept the first thing you see, either that's been shared with you or on a platform you like. Almost all of this will be online or digital rather than in print. And so work with students to work on the skills that sort of basically brings a little bit of a healthy skepticism or an ability to look up or research stuff through what's called lateral reading. So when you see something, you can quickly go to a second screen and maybe look something up rather than immediately accept it or share it. In addition to that curriculum, Poynter is the home of PolitiFact, which is the largest fact-checking independent fact-checking news site in the country, and through our PolitiFact network, we are going to create creating a network of teen fact-checkers, middle and high schoolers, who will be taught some of these same skills and who will, working with, say, student media advisors and others, will, when something they see, whether it's on Instagram or YouTube or something, is of interest or is passed along to them, that we will have this network that will do its own fact-checking and then share its findings with their friends. And so we're trying to improve that kind of news consumer literacy where they live, where these kids live. And again, I think it's resonant beyond just students to all of us.
And Lynn Walsh, you're the project manager, rather, of TrustingNews.org. And just based on what Neil was just saying, part of all of this is understanding the information that's in front of you, whether it's on a page or a screen, but it's also about understanding how it came to be there. So to what extent is it important to pull back the curtain and connect people with what they're seeing and explaining how it came to be there? How do you get people to be better consumers of news?
Yeah, so I think something that's important to keep in mind too is, you know, students, it's very important that we are trying to get this at a young age in middle school, high school, college, but also it's adults, right? Before, people received information, basically, it came to them, news. It was delivered to their doorstep, it came through their radio, it came through their TV screen. Now they're able to search it out. You know, before in the newspaper, they knew exactly where an opinion column might go. Now the articles are coming to them and these stories are coming, news, opinion, all kind of mixed together, either in their news feeds, on Facebook, on Twitter, and or being shared just with links, anything like that. So you do have to, there's a responsibility on the consumer, but also on the news organizations to, one, make sure that we're labeling content appropriately. So that's one of the seven strategies that the Trusting News Project is working with local newsrooms and other newsrooms with, is making sure you're labeling content, not using terms like op-ed, using terms that people know, opinion, label things as opinion, so that people know exactly what that is. But also it's talking about why you're covering this story, how you went about choosing stories, so story selection, who and why you interviewed certain people, who those individuals are, how you found them, and asking for feedback on your stories. Because something that we're finding is, you know, newsrooms aren't as diverse as the communities that we serve. So we may think that we are reaching out to the communities and getting all of the voices that are there, but we may be missing people. So it's asking for that feedback in the stories, which we hope when you ask for that feedback and someone says, wait, what about talking to this person or this group of people? Then when you do, you're adding more voices to the table, which hopefully will get rid of some of that bias and that thought of bias that some people think of when they think of media and newsrooms.
And speaking of what people think, let's get our callers in. When someone refers to, quote unquote, the media, what comes to mind for you? Do you think about your local stations or cable TV news or maybe legacy institutions like national newspapers? And if you don't trust media, what would it take to regain your trust? Give us a call, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. If you're a journalist, we'd also like to hear from you. How have people's reactions to you changed over the years, either on the job or maybe when you introduce yourself in social situations? What do people say to you now when you tell them, I am a journalist? And to what extent do you think people understand how news is made? Do you think reporters could maybe do a better job explaining that process? So whether you are a creator or a consumer of news, please give us a call and give us your thoughts. 866-798-8255. Neil Brown, was there ever a so-called golden age of news when people could trust what they saw? Was it the Walter Cronkite era? What happened if there ever was a time when the press enjoyed a higher popularity? If that was the case, when was it and what changed?
Well, you know, I'm sure we all like to romanticize about the good old days. There were certainly far fewer sources of information, and I do certainly think that as newspapers continued to do great investigative journalism, and then the advent of strong radio personalities and certainly TV personalities, and we always sort of default to the days of Walter Cronkite, there was that sort of sense of trusted source of information, and you could call that a golden age, and I think there's something to that. I would also say that there was so many fewer options, and to some degree this is the paradox we have now, right? That there are actually so many, I mean, we cited ProPublica today on some of this good work. Nothing like that even existed. The power of, even though there's been technological change that's been for the good, the power of it is fantastic. We have more eyeballs on journalism to some degree than ever before, and yet it also leads to a potential for abuse or mimicry or manufacturing of truth, and that's problematic. So I don't know that you can perfectly say there was a good day and now there's not a good day. I think there's some just fantastic work going on, and it just becomes, with progress, things become harder to make sure that you raise the standards and the level of play. But rather than run from it, we should just try to embrace it, as Lynn sort of says. We have to, I think, be more open about how we gather that information. I would say, back to that question and your earlier point about have things changed, I do think that I probably personally would trace it to the early 90s, 1990s, maybe with the Gulf War, that when cable TV news went 24/7 and there was this exceptional pressure to fill space, I personally saw what I thought was something of a reduction of standards, where in order to fill space you would loop images, which gave a sense that things were happening all around the clock, whether it's bombing in Iraq or something like that, when in fact it was the same imagery. There were, you saw in the 90s, I think, again, mostly on cable, some folks who would suddenly say, this is a rumor, but here it is. And mm-hmm. In the old days, before that, we wouldn't report a rumor until we had it properly sourced. So there was something of a change, I think, as there became more and more pressure to fill airtime, and then I believe to some degree the exceptional capacity of the internet has also allowed sort of a filling of open space with information that may not be as rigorous as it once was. That's, again, got its pluses in terms of the opportunity for the consumer, but it certainly has its challenges for those of us who practice journalism.
It also felt like a turning point, Neil, when reporters began to be embedded with military with the military, and obviously those stories were being filtered. And I thought, well, the good old days when a war correspondent was free to roam and go wherever they felt they could to get the story without necessarily interference from the government sources, I think that was a turning point too. Do you agree?
No, I do agree, although again, I think back to the notion of transparency that Aaron Linniff talked about, I think the embedding had its merits, but we needed to be much more clear about about what we were presenting, and that we were there as journalists because, yes, of, in a sense, an alliance with the government that we should be covering. So I would say I wouldn't be a purist to say we would never embed, but I definitely think that people couldn't discern the difference, and that was problematic. Now, that said, in an era even before that, you could argue that many of the Washington Press Corps were embedded just out of their friendships with sources that we never knew about, whether it was like Ben Bradley and John Kennedy, you know. So it's sanctimony is kind of hard on this front, but I do think that, yes, we are supposed to be covering the government, and it's hard when our access to those sources is reliant on a good relationship with them, and so that's a challenge and has been for journalism before, and it is today.
That's Neil Brown, president of the Poynter Institute. We're also joined today by Lynn Walsh, project manager at TrustingNews.org, and Aaron McNeil, founder and president of Media Literacy Now. And we hope you'll join us. We'll take a quick break and come right back. We're talking media literacy. Join us. Welcome back. I'm Renee Kemp, and this is the Friday Media Roundtable. We're joined today by three folks who are attempting to help us understand how journalists do their work and why the work that they do is so critical to our democracy. Joining us is Aaron McNeil, founder and president of Media Literacy Now, along with Lynn Walsh, project manager at TrustingNews.org, and Neil Brown, president of the Poynter Institute. And we hope you'll give us a call, 866-798-8255. We cannot ignore the fact that being a journalist in the age of Donald Trump is particularly challenging. Reporters are called enemies of the people. Reporters are kept literally in pens at Trump rallies. They're not free to roam around and speak to people at the rallies. They are frequently enjoined to turn around, look at the journalists in the pen, and they've been spat on and sworn at, and they are literally subjects of ridicule from a podium that bears the seal of the President of the United States. So, Lynn, I'll ask you first, how are journalists particularly challenged in an environment like this?
Well, your question, it was interesting when you were telling journalists to call in and what happens when you tell someone you're a journalist. And I know even for me personally, it's definitely changed in the last, I would say, 5 years. Before, people were kind of more receptive and positive, right? It was like, oh, wow, that's really cool. Sounds like a cool job. Sounds really interesting. And now, almost immediately, the term fake news will come out of someone's mouth when you mention that you're a journalist. So because of the rhetoric that's happening at the national level, but also at the local level, with claims of fake news, the claims from the White House specifically, and other lawmakers and people in power, it is making the job harder than it used to be, just when it comes to coverage and access, but then also covering communities and getting people, you know, to believe what you are publishing. Before, that wasn't as much of an issue. You would publish something and people assumed that it was true. And now people may actually assume that it's false instantly. So those are challenges that journalists around the country are facing right now. And what we are hoping to do at the Trusting News Project is help newsrooms change that perspective within their community. And we're doing that through seven strategies that are primarily based on increasing transparency, encouraging engagement with news consumers, and asking for feedback, and then acting on that feedback, and then also explaining what we do as journalists and how we do it. So some quick things that we talk about is, you know, an anonymous source. When you ask a member of the public, what does it mean when a journalist uses an anonymous source? You get lots of different answers, but primarily what people assume is that I, as the journalist, don't know the person. And that's actually most of the time not true. Normally, I've met them in person, I've had a phone conversation, and my editor knows who they are. I'm just not identifying them for some protection that they may need, their life may be in danger, anything like that. And so there are just some misconceptions in some areas where journalists and the public are not on the same page with terms that we're using, things that we're doing, why we're doing our jobs. And I think if we can get on that same page, that we can have better conversations and help rebuild that trust in our news stories and in journalism as a whole.
So something just as basic as vocabulary, making sure people are using the right terms, is important. We have an email from Bill in Berkeley, who writes, in a 2014 report, Pew Research reported that there were, at that time, about 5 PR professionals working in the U.S. for each journalist. So that's a 5-to-1 PR to journalist ratio. Additionally, he writes, the PR folks are much better paid, approximately $55,000 a year versus about $36,000 for a journalist. And Bill wants to know, how does this discrepancy affect the news? Is much of what gets reported just basically rehashed PR releases? Aaron McNeil, president of Media Literacy Now, your thoughts on that?
I think that it's true that there are a lot of the PR is getting into the news because journalists are working, overworked. Mm. There's a lot of news happening to cover, and sometimes they will rely on press releases that come in. But obviously, they're still doing their work in many instances. And I think that really the local news reporters are they're still the most trusted source. They have a lot of news to cover. They do have the support of their communities. I think it's up to maybe them. I think there's a growing movement at the local level of good, solid investigative reporting. And I think it's up to the journalists to kind of make the case for themselves and why they matter today. When they teach the public, as Lynn was saying, about what they do and how we do it, how you find sources, how you use them, that sort of thing, that is media literacy. So by doing that work, you're teaching media literacy. By teaching journalism itself, you're teaching media literacy.
But what happens when your local news is brought to you by Sinclair, a pair of right-wing, politically active brothers who have bought up a string of television stations in flyover America, medium-sized markets, you know, Joplin, Missouri, Akron, Ohio, smaller mid-sized markets, and they have mandatory editorials that are run. And in some cases, those editorials are being read by Muffy and Biff, the anchors that you've come to know and trust. But it doesn't get revealed that this is a mandatory editorial from the owners. Neil Brown, Poynter Institute, how dangerous is that?
Well, it's a direct collision with what we do as journalists, and both Aaron and Lynn were suggesting, I mean, let's go back to the beginning, which is independent journalism requires transparency. It requires revealing who your sources are. It requires being direct with your audience as to where the information comes from. In fact, to the interesting point about not even understanding anonymous sources, we should be using fewer of them anyways because sometimes it's necessary for very delicate stories, but I think news organizations in general should have a very high bar before they go with not being able to tell their audience where they've got their information. Now, that said, when you take a situation like Sinclair, you mentioned it, Renee, at the top of the show, when there's a consolidation of ownership in our ranks, that leads to basically a very controlled press. We don't think that's a good idea. We think at minimum, whether it's Sinclair or the anchors or any station or any of the major chains, they should be open and transparent, and they should follow almost the 7 principles that Lynn suggested. It's very important that trust starts with not just the attitude of the consumer, but that you trust people to decide for themselves and process the information rather than feel you have to disguise it or mask it or script it. And it's bad for independent journalism. And I think part of what's happened in the last few years as these trust matters have risen to the top is we need to cover our own industry even more assertively, which is hard in times of tight resources, but we should be open about how the process works.
Remember the good old days when you could not, by law, own a television station and a newspaper in the same market to avoid the very kind of consolidation that is now just commonplace? That was a long time ago, and then again, it seems like a time far, far away when it comes to people getting their information. And it also seems to me that it's not accidental. It's deliberate, the smudging of the lines between editorial and news coverage. Let's go to the phones, and we welcome your calls, 866-798-8255. We're talking media literacy. Let's go to Bert in Oakland. Hi, Bert.
Hello?
Hi, go right ahead.
Yes, I teach journalism at Laney College in Oakland. I teach a class called Survey of Mass Media. And the first thing I tell the students is the word media is plural. And there are many, many different sources of news, and we talk about that. And I bring in speakers from places like the Center for Investigative Reporting and talk about new things happening in the media, people trying to make a difference, such as Joaquin Alvarado, who started Studio 2B in Oakland, and trying, he's doing a good job getting students involved, taking new looks, new ways of looking at journalism. And also we talk in the class about, there's an excellent documentary on Netflix called Nobody Speak, Trials of the Free Press. And it really shows how billionaires get involved and really have a hand in the media. And this was about the Hulk Hogan case and how the billionaire Peter Thiel was able to bring down Gawker by helping to fund this invasion of privacy case. And the other thing I want to mention, a very good source if people are really interested in a critique of the media, is the Columbia Journalism Review, which you can find easily at cjr.org. And one other thing I just want to mention, that this last semester, one of the students in my class was Michelle Snyder. And she was a young woman who went over to Lake Merritt and filmed the woman who was calling the police on two black men who were barbecuing.
Oh, Barbecue Becky.
Barbecue Becky, right. So Michelle Snyder is the student, and she told us in the class that this is something, it's actually her husband was one of the two men who phoned her, sent a text with a photo of Becky, and her husband said, if I wind up in jail tonight, this is why. So Michelle decided that this is something she had to do. She really had to go down there and document that. So there are a lot of people that are really getting involved in trying to make a change, as you mentioned, the Trump era, making it, to call journalists the enemy of the people is obscene, I think.
Thank you, Bert. Citizen journalism is so common. Aaron McNeil, president of Media Literacy, you're actually advocating for state legislatures to include media literacy in public school classrooms. Tell us a bit about that.
We're working across the country to educate policymakers on the importance of media literacy from K through 12, not just news literacy, but all kinds of media literacy skills, so that students, like today, students are using social media quite a bit, and they start very young. That's having some effect, we believe, on their mental health, for example. Media also has effects on public health, on violence, obesity. It has a strong effect that has been proven, and media literacy has been proven to be able to help people understand where the messages are coming from and why, and how they affect themselves. So children, instead of just receiving these messages, are saying, okay, well, you know, who put this here and why, and do I need to believe it? You know, not necessarily. So that starts really young. That should start. Kindergarten is obviously a good time to start, because before then it's really the parents. And so when students learn media literacy in school, they'll bring it back to their parents, and the parents learn that way, and later on, students become the parents to teach the younger children.
Mm-hmm.
So we've gotten five bills passed across the country, and these are kind of the first step to get people thinking about media literacy as a key essential part of education in the schools today.
All right, very good. Let's go next to Amanda in San Francisco. Hi, Amanda. Thanks for hanging on. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yes, my comment is about TV journalism. And what I would like to say is that for years, I've never listened to ABC, NBC, CBS News, because we all know that they're corporate entities. I used to listen to the PBS NewsHour when their wonderful journalist, Gwen Ifill, was alive. And I think it's so unfortunate that she met an early demise in a painful way. But I have noticed that it was very important for me. I realized how the standards for that journalism went way downhill after she was no longer on the show. Sometimes when I'm flipping through the channels, I look at the sponsors. And now on PBS NewsHour, their top sponsor is the Koch brothers. No surprise. But I would like to recommend, I listen to get my most trustworthy news from now, BBC Radio News and CBC Radio News, Canadian Broadcast Corporation. And I find they give a much less biased view of the news and a more broad spectrum view of the news, including what is going on in the United States.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. Isn't it interesting that people are sometimes very person-specific in terms of the trust that they invest in the information they're getting? It might be the Walter Cronkite effect. I loved Gwen Ifill as well, but I don't know that I trust Judy Woodruff any less. But once again, Lynn Walsh, you're at trustingnews.org. Can you weigh in on how personality-specific some trust issues can be when it comes to news consuming?
Yeah, so actually one of the strategies that we talk about is using individual personality and credibility. So when you are the journalist talking about what is your experience covering this topic, like if you've sat through 20, 30, 100 city council meetings, you know, adding that in your bio and including that at the bottom of stories to give that kind of credibility and some of that just kind of background history, you know, you have this experience. You've maybe attended more city council meetings than some of the city council members that are up there that are in office currently. So that kind of credibility and talking about that and not being afraid to share some of those facts, I think, is really important because these are things that people want to know. Something else about individuality, it's not just about the reporters, but also the newsroom. So the caller mentioned, you know, that ABC, CBS, NBC are corporately owned. Well, in some cases, so I used to work at the NBC station here in San Diego. That was owned by a corporate. But for the most part, these affiliate stations are actually just affiliates carrying the name brand of the companies and are actually owned by smaller media companies. And they're not as small as they used to be. They are bigger. But I think that's important to know that it doesn't go straight to New York in some cases. It's going to Cincinnati, to Scripps. It's going to Gannett in Virginia. So there's this different ownership makeups that I think is extremely important for consumers to understand. But in order for consumers to understand, we as journalists need to talk about it and not being afraid to explain, here's how we use content from NPR. Here's what it means when we're affiliated with the NBC, the ABC, the CBS. Here's where we use stuff that comes from DC. So talking about those sort of things and talking about also funding for some of these nonprofits that are popping up. Where does funding come from? And if you use sponsored content, what does that mean? Do they have a say in any of that? Explaining all of that is very, very important.
And also the idea that Bert brought up, the actual definition of the word media. One recent survey found that the public asked about so-called fake news. They often think about MSNBC, CNN, Fox, big national outlets. And I think it's because there's so much punditry that goes on that's woven in with actual reporting. But the same surveys find that people often do trust and respect their local newspaper, for example. They just don't think of that as media, so to speak. Let's go to another call. Alicia in Berkeley is weighing in about local news coverage. Hi, Alicia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is a great program. I really appreciate it. And I just wanted to comment that the scales first fell from my eyes in 1964 when I participated in the free speech movement at Cal, and then read what the Berkeley Gazette, how they were reporting it, which was totally biased towards the university and completely inaccurate. And so ever since then, I've been a little suspicious of local news because I feel like there's power structures locally as well as nationally that influence the news. Recently, a friend of mine who's a reporter up in Mount Shasta did an article on the water situation up there and almost lost her job because the developer was claiming that her reporting was completely inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
It's really it's very hard to figure out. I sometimes feel like if you want to know the truth, wait 10 years. Maybe it will come out. But I just wondered if your guests could comment on what they feel the differences between national news and local news as far as believability and the influences that go into the reporting.
Good question. Thanks, Alicia. Neil Brown, Poynter Institute. You want to handle that one?
Sure. And I couldn't totally hear the whole thing, but I think I got the gist of it in any event. And all of you on the program have sort of made this point that I think that to some degree the trust issue gets kind of oversimplified because of the extremely politically polarized environment we're in right now, and that I believe if we can tell the story, as Aaron and Lynn have suggested, of what we're doing, how we do it, and connect with folks much more at a local level, where, by the way, this kind of information is needed more than ever. It's needed so you know what your sewer bills are going to be. You need to know about it because it's not on the nightly news, and so we want to know what our local school board members are up to. We want to know about zoning for a restaurant near our house or for a nursing home near our house. We want to hold people accountable at a local level, and I think if we can get away from the R's and the D's and the blue state and the red state, at least not exclusively, that's important to the conversation about our society as well, but right now there's a lot of great journalism going on at a local level that is making a difference in communities. And one of the greatest threats to our democracy is that, in fact, because of the corporate ownership described in other places, there has been basically a consolidation and even an evaporation of organizations, smaller news organizations. They either don't have the resources or they're evaporating altogether, and there are whole communities that are not being covered at a local level. In any event, I think the point is that trust is better achieved face-to-face with people. If you know who your neighbors are, if you know who your local news reporters are, whatever form that comes in, and that we can grow trust and should grow trust from the ground up, and then some of this political fury at the higher levels will have to sort itself out. But right now, I think we should be supporting local news organizations as a way to build trust and to improve communities in a much quicker time frame than the national dialogue.
Well, Aaron, journalists in some ways have their hands tied. I mean, you're not supposed to advocate really for anything. So lobbying for media literacy could on some level be seen as unethical. But how do you use the voices of journalists to try and support the programs that you run at Media Literacy Now?
Well, we don't expect journalists themselves to lobby for legislation. Obviously, that wouldn't work when they are supposed to be the watchdogs of the government. Certainly, as I said earlier, journalists can certainly advocate for themselves and their industry. And you know, we should be making the case for what journalists do and why it's necessary for democracy. There's nothing wrong with that. And it's also, as has been mentioned, talking about how we do it, how the work is done, where the stories come from, why we're covering these things. I think that's all part of the package. Personally, I think we're looking at, when you talk about the golden age of journalism, I think we may be going into it with the internet giving access to so many more people. As more people become media literate, understand how to read messages and the news and be more critical and have a healthy skepticism. And at the same time, we have lower barriers to entry so that we're getting more voices, more stories are coming out. I think that it's a huge opportunity, and many people are taking advantage of it. We're seeing all sorts of new models of local news. So I'm excited.
Well, I'm so glad that you're excited, because frankly, I'm a little scared. and you know, I think a lot of people are. And so in our closing minutes, I wanted to read a Twitter comment from Stephen, who is worried. He says, journalism will not recover from Trump's attacks until he is irrefutably discredited. Mistakes will be blown out of proportion. In the meantime, it's imperative to be accurate beyond the pale. Call out your own errors quickly, and don't take and respond to attacks personally, however personal they are. So with just about a minute and a half left, Neil, can you just speak to how to go forward in the era of Trump with about a minute and a half to go?
Yeah, Stephen's got I think Stephen's got a really good point. Marty Baron of the Washington Post has a great line from the get-go when he said that we are not at war, we are at work. And I think that that's what journalists have to keep in mind. Keep your standards high. Obviously, we need to respond to the kind of attacks. We can't completely ignore them, but it's very important not to be compromised, because that is a tactic to undermine independent journalism. So we got, to some degree, execute our work very well at a high ethical standard, as Stephen, I think his name was, suggested. Own up to mistakes, be transparent about how we do our work. People will find it interesting, and they will appreciate the humanity if we're just open about what we do and aim high for it.
All right. Lynn, I'm sorry, we're going to let Neil Brown have the last word on that, and I think it's a good way to wrap. Thank you so much, Neil Brown, president of Poynter Institute, Lynn Walsh, project manager at TrustingNews.org, and Aaron McNeil, founder and president of Media Literacy Now. And thank you all for joining us. Thanks to our listeners for tuning in and for your emails and phone calls. Sorry we couldn't get to everyone, but you can listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast at YourCallRadio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Our Andrew Stelzer is today's producer. Laura Winnes is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.